Hello and welcome to another edition of the smash hit economic game show, What is Janet Yellen Thinking? You all know the rules, five words or less. We'll be back right after these messages. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday is upon us, everybody, the second day of October. Good as always to have you here. We will get to the question of the day in a minute. It is, of course, W-I-J-Y-T. But first, there is actual economic data to talk about. This morning's job report is where we're going to start the next four or so minutes of our collective lives. Cardiff Garcia is here to help wrap things up. He's in our New York studio. He is from FD Alphaville. Also, Sabri Benishore from our New York Bureau, the Marketplace staff there, is with us as well. Sabri, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. Cardiff, the first question goes to you, man. 142,000 new jobs, 5.1 on the unemployment rate. How you feeling, yo?
It's a bit of a bummer, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not a catastrophic divergence from the earlier trend, and we've had soft patches of data before and gotten through them, but it's for sure a disappointment. It shows that the pace of jobs growth has slowed. I'm a little worried that previously jobs growth was broad-based throughout the economy, but actually the number of sectors with growing numbers of jobs has declined. And also, you have to look at the fact that earlier months had their numbers revised down, mm-hmm. and that's traditionally not a very good sign. So obviously, it's not time to panic, as you like to remind your listeners, but yeah, it's a bit of a bummer, you know?
Yeah, Sabri, not time to panic yet. I mean, I'm being facetious, but there's a little bit of, well, what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the labor force participation rate went down, and you could look at that two ways. You could think, well, maybe more people, even more people, are just saying, throwing in the towel and just not even looking. But mm-hmm. it could also be that maybe there's fewer people looking because it's not so bad.
Right.
I mean, there's
right.
kind of a positive way to look at it.
Sabri, I mean, Cardiff, let's go back to you for the question that we started the show with a couple of days ago, this idea of uncertainty, that here we have now. The president just this afternoon was taking questions on the debt limit, for crying out loud. And Congress can't decide quite what to do about the debt limit. And there's talk of a government shutdown. And the Federal Reserve, which we'll get to in a minute, is sort of like, yeah, well, not raising rates, but whatever. Talk to me for a second about uncertainty as the economic vibe of the moment.
Well, it doesn't help, you know.
okay, thanks
so
for coming
I
by.
Think,
see you later.
Yeah, I think we need to distinguish between different kinds of uncertainty. So you mentioned a government shutdown. That's the kind of thing that usually only has a mild effect on the economy. Yeah. It can be disruptive for a short period of time, but usually the economy bounces back. But the worries about the debt ceiling that you mentioned earlier, now that's a much bigger problem. And that's something we really don't want hanging over our heads anymore. It's really kind of a shame that we keep having this fight again and again. And it looks like we might have to have it again coming up in November. So yeah, that's a bit of a problem. And even the psychological effect of worrying that it could happen can also have an effect. So yeah, it's also a bummer.
Yeah, also, all right, we got a lot of bummers. Sabri, a quick nod to equities and uncertainty before we get to the question of the day. Wall Street has been up, down, all around. Clearly, traders are looking at this saying, you know, make up your minds, people, will you? What are we going to do with this economy?
Yeah, well, they have a lot to be really uncertain about and be all over the place about. I mean, there's still even concerns about China, let alone this stuff. I mean, I think mm-hmm. there's a ton on their minds right now. It's pretty, frankly, opaque. I know a lot of things are worrying them, and I mean, pick one out of 20.
All right, so Cardiff, just because Sabri brought it up, we haven't heard a lot about China the past couple of weeks, even though Xi Jinping was here this past week. Uncertainty over there probably not helping at all in our problems, huh?
Not at all. I mean, the effects from China or from global declines or global slowdowns in general tend to be indirect. But you can take the example where, you know, a lot of American companies sell things overseas. And if that slows down, then they'll be worried about their bottom lines and subsequently hiring people at home. So that's just one example of how this can have an effect. The U.S. economy is fairly robust to these kinds of things. So it would take a lot of damage overseas to really dramatically harm it. But again, a lot of uncertainty and it doesn't help.
Yeah. All right. So 30 seconds left. We're going to play my favorite game. What is Janet Yellen thinking? Cardiff, you get to go first. Five words or less. Begin.
How about I'll wait until I'm sure?
I'll wait until I'm sure. Okay. All right. That's five. Yeah. Sabri, you're up. Go.
December, everyone will get over it.
December, everyone will get over it. All right, you guys win, although we'll see. We'll have you back in a couple of weeks. Sabri Benishore from our staff in New York, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Sure.
All right, see you. Have a good weekend. It took them a while, but traders decided they did like that jobs number after all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Stop me if you've heard this one before, but there's been another big data breach. The world's biggest credit data firm, Experian, could be facing criminal investigations and fines, class action lawsuits, after a hack that compromised the records of 15 million people, all of them customers of the wireless carrier T-Mobile, including yours truly, which makes it more hacks of my data than I care to count. And really, these stories do seem to have become pretty standard. There's a hack, promises of free credit monitoring, and life goes on, yeah? Yeah, no. Marketplace's Nova Sappho now on why those oh-so-common hacks are actually worse than we think.
I'll add to Kai's story with my own. My mom had her identity stolen. Someone filed fake tax returns in her name. You probably know someone with a similar story. People who've had car loans open in their name, mortgages, credit cards.
Law enforcement can't deal with the volume.
That's Chester Wisniewski. He's a senior advisor at the security firm Sophos.
If you approach the FBI, they're not really interested if the crime is less than $1 million.
So this is becoming an epidemic problem.
Cybersecurity analyst Aviva Leighton of Gartner Research says some state agencies are telling her that they have more taxpayers with compromised IDs than those without. But Leighton says in almost all cases, hackers don't care to defraud you. No, they're selling your data for espionage.
But you may end up helping a nation state get some military plans because your kid happens to go to a school with the defense contractor's kid.
So you get hacked, a legit-looking email with a virus gets sent to the defense contractor, who opens it because it looks like it's from you, and the hackers are in. One answer to all of this, says Christopher Segoyan, a privacy researcher at the ACLU, is to rethink our identification system.
We need to stop using the Social Security number as a secret. Everyone's Social Security number at one point or another now has been hacked and stolen.
Security experts say for consumers, the options are few. The best is to freeze your credit, not just monitor it, so most fraudulent activity can be stopped before it happens. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Amazon has decided to stop selling Apple TV and Google Chromecast, both quite popular video streaming products. Amazon will, of course, continue to sell its own streaming device, Fire TV. Not coincidentally, Fire TV works quite nicely with Amazon's streaming service, Prime Video, and, of course, Amazon would like very much for more people to sign up for Prime. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story.
In a giant office on the top floor of a tall tower in a dark gray place called Seattle, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos swivels in his massive chair to his minions. Petting a white cat, he whispers, "Google, Apple, banish them." Okay, not really. For all we know, Bezos has a cat allergy and a standing desk. There's no Bond villain drama. Amazon execs are just giving up a cut of hardware sales in an attempt to rule streaming media.
Question is the revenue from content distribution more than the device? And the answer definitely is yes.
That's University of North Carolina business professor Arvin Malhotra. The battle for streaming customers is a tough one with no certain outcome. So Amazon's using its e-commerce muscle.
This is a clear winner-take-all market.
Jerry Kim teaches strategy at Columbia Business School.
Once a lot of people are on a particular platform, you tend to get locked in. It's very hard for people to switch out to another system. So I think they're trying to race ahead and get more market share in this war to lock people out from other content providers.
Certain corners of the internet wonder whether Amazon could face regulatory trouble. NYU antitrust law professor Scott Hemphill doesn't. Actually, when Amazon and other companies play hardball with each other, it can be pretty cool.
These attacks on each other's strongholds, we should applaud that.
Amazon's a retail powerhouse. Apple has devices and iTunes. Google dominates search. If they fight it out hard enough, they might end up making something we can use. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The center of global trade this week has been Atlanta, Georgia, of all places. Now, I love Atlanta, went to school there, but you don't usually find high-level trade negotiations happening there. The latest round of talks on the Trans-Pacific Partnership is going on right now. The U.S., Japan, Canada, Mexico, 12 countries total. It's a big piece, arguably the economic piece of the Obama administration's Asian agenda. These negotiations have stretched over years, literally, but now might, with an emphasis on the might, be down to their final hours. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is in Atlanta. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Kai.
So listen, is this thing really going to wrap up tomorrow? I mean, they've extended it. This is their second big meeting. What are the possibilities? What are the odds?
Yeah, it seems close, it feels close, but you just kind of never know with these things. Obviously, with the last round of negotiations in Hawaii earlier this summer, there was some optimism around that. It didn't pan out. But we have seen some movement on some of the big issues that derailed Hawaii talks earlier this summer.
All right, so give me a couple of examples. Is there a sticking point in Atlanta that they're making progress on?
There is one, and it's called Rules of Origin, and this is related to the auto industry and what percentage of cars and car parts have to come from within the TPP countries in order to qualify for the, you know, the benefits of the agreement, the reduced tariffs, that sort of thing. So NAFTA had set one level for those quote-unquote rules of origin. These talks were looking at something lower than that. Mexico was unhappy about that, but there does seem to be some progress. They seem close to working out that issue.
Once they get a deal, whether it's in Atlanta tomorrow or someplace else some other time, it's worth remembering this still has to get to the Congress, right?
Right, and that is going to be really hard. This thing is by no means over if they come to an agreement at Atlanta. It's in some ways, it's just the beginning because it's going to be a fight to get this through Congress.
You got to go to Hawaii a couple of months ago. Now you're in Atlanta. Scenery's different. I imagine the players are the same. What about the conversation in the hallways, like standing in the Starbucks and stuff?
Yeah, there is a Starbucks here. There was a Starbucks in Maui, so we are literally standing at the Starbucks. Talk here is really focused around three main issues: the rule of origin that we talked about, how much countries are going to open up their dairy markets, and the final issue, which may be the last issue that holds this thing up, is about the monopoly length for certain kinds of drugs. Basically, how long drug makers get a period of exclusivity to sell those drugs before they open it up to generics. So it might come down to that last issue, but at the same time, those three issues are now so interrelated, right, that they all kind of hinge on each other, and countries giving something here to get something there. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the end.
Because it is 40% of the global economy. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson in Atlanta covering the TPP. Thank you, Tracy.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up.
And the firefighters described it, the fire had fingers. You know, it just reached in and just burned this whole area.
Rebuilding in Bastrop County, Texas, 4 years on. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 200 points, 1.2% today, closed at 16,472. I will tell you that at the opening bell, the Dow dropped 200 points. It had a 400-point swing today. That's a whole lot of motion. The NASDAQ grew 80 points, 1.7%, finished at 47.07. The S&P 500 climbed 27 points, 1.4%, 19.51. For the week, the Dow up 1%, the NASDAQ up about 0.5%. The S&P 500 gained 1% as well. Thanks to that competition heating up over streaming we told you about, Amazon delivered 2.2% today. Google up 2.3%, Apple up 0.7%. Consumer credit monitoring giant Experian, of which we told you, down 3.8% today on that news and that massive hack. Thank you very little. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.98%. Ask yourself this, people, what is Janet Yellen thinking? You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. From the climate change files now, this item: India, the last of the world's big economies to do so, has ponied up its pledge to cut carbon emissions. That basically means everybody's in: China, the European Union, and the United States. However, there is a sense that India and all the rest of us, too, need to do more to hit key emissions targets than we have already promised, because it's expensive to cut carbon. And also, it's voluntary. Each of us would rather have somebody else pay up before we do. So from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now on what economists like to call the free rider problem.
Think of something we all use: a park, a library, clean air, but would rather not pay for. This is the free rider problem. Energy consultant Stephen Stoft has his example.
Wikipedia. They put in a lot of effort, money, and time, and we just go use it for free, and we don't bother to donate.
The thing about free riding is it's particularly tempting to do nothing or to do little when it costs me a lot and other people get the benefits. And that's how cleaning up carbon pollution works. Harvard economist Martin Weitzman says that's why just about every pledge, India's, China's, America's, is insufficient.
It's not enough to really address head-on this problem. Everyone is tempted to come in with a low target, leaving the rest of the world to mostly determine the abatement level.
The goal of the Paris climate meeting in December is to put those pledges down and then have everyone promise to be more ambitious. The evidence, though, suggests people tend not to work that way. Peter Crampton teaches economics at the University of Maryland.
Some countries will observe that other countries are not doing their share, and as a result, they'll say, well, I'm not going to do my share either then. And in fact, you get an unraveling of cooperation.
He says this doomed a previous treaty, the Kyoto Protocol, when Japan and Canada opted out. In an upcoming paper, Crampton suggests any patchwork of voluntary commitments, like these climate talks, will fail. The incentive to ride for free is too strong. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The two big wildfires that did so much damage and killed six people up in Northern California last month are now fully or nearly fully contained. And yet, we are still not done with fire season out here. 4 years ago, the most devastating fire ever in the state of Texas ripped through Bastrop County. 50 square miles, nearly 2,000 homes burned just a half hour's drive from Austin. Residents there had a choice, the same choice people are going to have up in Northern California. They could rebuild or they could hit the road. Marketplace's Andy Euler went back to Bastrop to see what's up.
Melissa Bishop moved out here to Bastrop and out into the country about 20 years ago.
You know, I don't want to live in an exurb of Austin and the whole thing is coming this way with the suburban houses and the big box stores and the traffic jams. It's coming.
She worked as a nurse in downtown Austin, but commuted an hour every day to live in the forest. And that's what it is. Bastrop State Park is almost 10 square miles of pines, which makes it susceptible to fire. The fire in 2011 burned about 95% of the park.
And if you look over there on the horizon, you can see completely burned dead trees. That was a crown fire, like a horizontal tornado rolling through the forest that's so hot that it explodes the trees in front of it.
She was renting land next to the park. She owned a cabin but didn't have insurance. Now all that's left is a mailbox. She got $32,000 from FEMA and bought some land in Oregon. She hopes to move there by the end of the year. But Bishop is the exception. While a lot of people didn't rebuild on the same piece of land, Bastrop didn't lose population numbers or school enrollment. The city of Bastrop is the county seat, and yes, it has a town square and a bunch of little ice cream parlors. But the fire just hit the edge of the city. Nearly all the homes destroyed were in the county. Officials are trying to assure residents that they're ready for the next one. And there will be a next one. Bruce Woods is head of mitigation and prevention at the Texas A&M Forest Service.
We can't stop all fires. And fires are going to occur, either lightning strikes or... So we're going to have ignition starts. And it's how we prepare our homes that's going to make the difference.
Lots of new people are moving out here, and developers are building them houses. Subdivisions are sprouting all along Highway 71 among thousands of burned trees. Woods thinks these communities need to be planned better, and builders need incentives to build fire-safe homes.
We have numerous areas where we've had catastrophic fires in Texas, and properties were rebuilt with the same materials and the same type of landscaping as before the fire.
That's exactly what Jenny Pickering did. The same house on the same lot.
My daughter-in-law called the builder who had built our home, which was only 5 years old, and told him what was going on. And he called me and said, Jenny, if you want to rebuild, I'll put you at the top of my list. So we decided to rebuild. So we used the same floor plan, everything. We just rebuilt the same exact house. We did the best we could to get it back the way it was.
She says she didn't really do anything to make her home more fire safe, but she's not sure it would have made any difference. A few miles down the road is Tahitian Village. You can see plenty of lots where only chimneys remain. Folks who live out here aren't farmers and ranchers. They're living on quarter-acre lots in modern-looking houses. That's where I met Jan Kuchel.
My house is wood. It's old. It's about 30 years old. But it's also got asphalt shingles, you know, that have been replaced a couple of times.
Kuchel knows she's lucky that her place didn't burn down because so many in her neighborhood did.
And the firefighters described it, the fire had fingers. You know, it just reached in and just burned this whole area.
And then there could be a house that went completely down, two or three houses that went completely down, and the house next to it had flowers blooming in the front yard.
She says when she heard her house was okay, she was excited. That it was hard to go to the store and talk to her neighbors because she felt kind of guilty.
You know, any time I would say, no, my home is there, you would see almost, I want to say disappointment in their eyes, you know, because it felt like, oh, I don't have a comrade here, you know. And then there was a point in time when people said, oh, you didn't lose your home. Oh, okay, you're fine then. And I wanted to just kind of punch them.
Kuchel spent $50,000 to repair damages her insurance company wouldn't cover. Her siding was warped. She replaced all her carpet. She repaved the driveway because the fire was so hot it melted the asphalt. Her survivor's guilt went away, and she knows the people in her community a lot better. She had plenty of reason to see them. County and state officials held seminars on how to make homes safer. She and her neighbors even organized meetings to talk about how to get out in case of another fire.
It's astonishing to me that I didn't ever take it any more seriously. It's astonishing to me.
As thousands of people look for tranquility in the piney woods outside of Bastrop, Kuchel says she hopes they can take something from her short-sightedness, especially those coming out from the city.
You can give them a little bit of leeway for being dumb, but I don't get any excuse.
I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
You can see where Melissa Bishop is living now out in Bastrop in a video on our Facebook page or at our website, marketplace.org. There's a brand new world-class art museum here in Los Angeles. It's called The Broad. It's about 2.5-3 blocks from Marketplace World headquarters, right in the middle of downtown. It was built by, and it contains, the personal art collection of billionaire real estate developer Eli Broad. If you happen to be out here and are thinking of stopping by, you're going to want to wait a month, maybe two, especially on a weekend, because one of the Broad's big selling points, besides the collection, which is supposed to be amazing, is the price of admission, which is free. About a third of museums in this country don't charge admissions at all. So we asked Marketplace's Adrienne Hill how they can afford to do that.
Joanne Heiler, the director of the Broad Museum, has to worry about a lot of things. Fundraising isn't one of them.
Amongst colleagues, I have this sort of wry comment I often make that we don't have a development department. The development department is me, and I have one prospect.
The prospect, of course, is the Broad family, which funds the endowment that funds the museum and makes attendance free.
We felt that it was important to remove as many barriers as we could.
Lots of museums would like to remove those barriers, and entrance fees, on average, make up less than a tenth of museum revenues. The Dallas Museum of Art dropped its general admission in 2013. Robert Stein is the museum's deputy director.
And so while it was a small downtick in revenues, the upside on fulfilling our mission and changing the way that we can reach our audience was worth the sacrifice.
Stein says attendance is up 50%. So why aren't more museums free? Elizabeth Merritt is from the American Alliance of Museums. She says not every museum can make up that lost revenue with grants, gifts, sponsorships.
I think what often gets lost in the conversation about how everybody would like museums to be free is that somebody still has to pay for it.
She says there are instances of museums dropping general admission with the help of donors or a foundation and then having to reinstitute it when the money dries up. Never a popular move. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, because nothing says romance like the Federal Reserve and credit scores. Be still my heart. Bloomberg had an article today about a new study out from the New York Fed. The topic was, to quote the economists involved, household formation and dissolution. Romantic, I know, but it gets better. Turns out people with higher credit scores are more likely to be in a committed relationship and stay together. Also, we tend to form relationships with people who have credit scores similar to ours, which just, I know, gets you all warm and fuzzy, doesn't it? I love you. Want to come up and see my credit scores? All right, today the Dow gained 200 points, 1.2%. The NASDAQ grew 80 points, 1.7%. The S&P 500 climbed 27 points, 1.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.